call this committee to order. We don't have a quorum, so I think we will just begin. Members, today we're going to hear from the an overview of on the value-based reimbursement along with two bills. So we'll be taking action on those bills today. The bills need not be referred through the floor, but will be referred to the possession of the Health and Human Services Reform Committee. And then a memo will be sent to Chair Schumacher memorializing the subcommittee's actions. So that's how this will work. So today we're going to hear an update on the value-based reimbursement and what's been happening with the bill that was passed in 2015 by DHS as well as some providers. So Ms. Cook, is Valerie Cook here? Welcome back, and appreciate you coming, and if you wouldn't mind, when you're ready, introducing yourself for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Cook, and I'm the Division Director for Nursing Facility Rates and Policy Division at DHS. So as you mentioned, I'm just here to give kind of a brief highlight overview of what we've learned about the impact of value-based reimbursement so far to date with some preliminary data that we've collected. And so we'll just dive right in to just sort of touch back on a summary of what VBR did. Basically, was we moved to a cost-based system where care-related costs are subject to a quality-based limit, and other operating costs are set as a pricing model, meaning that every facility gets the same rate for other operating costs. And another big change was health insurance costs are treated now as a pass-through in a different piece of the rate component that I can tell you a little bit more about. And also the past systems usually had geographic groupings, so it was metro and non-metro or deep rural facilities had different rate effects. And then we also had some hospital-based attached facilities and freestanding facilities were treated differently in previous systems. And so those facility type groups have been eliminated as well under VBR. It does contain a hold harmless feature so that facilities don't experience steep rate decreases from year to year. And the VBR did not address the property system at this point. It did direct DHS to do a property study, which is underway right now. So some of the primary goals for VBR was to address workforce issues. So the intention being that facilities could invest in improved wages and improved benefit packages. And there also the design does include a quality incentive with the idea being with higher rates, limits allowed based on higher facility quality scores. So the idea being that we would pay more for higher quality facilities. So this is a comparison of rate years for the last 3 years. VBR went into effect in January 1st of 2016, and so that's where you see some of the larger rate increases. And then from 2016 to now this January of 2017, it kind of stabilized a bit. One particular statistic I think that stands out is that external fixed rate component. So you see a 47% increase, and that's primarily a shift in where health insurance costs were previously reported as in the other operating cost category. And so now, so that's why you'll see a large shift there, probably due to the health insurance. But overall, the rates increased upon enactment of VBR of about 21%. And then this year, as noted, it's just under 2%. The rates increased in January of 2017. So we did do an interim cost report. One of the challenges to really capture the impact of VBR is the 27-month lag. And so the cost reports that are just being filed now in 2017 is the first real cost report we have that has actual costs under the new VBR system that was started January 1st of 2016. And so we did just a mini cost report, collected some data from two pay periods in the first 6 months of 2016 to get some initial results. And so as you can see, overall wage per hour increase has averaged about 10% across the various categories, with primarily the CNAs and getting the biggest increase of about 11%. But overall, 91% of the facilities reported that they did give employees a wage increase with the funding from VBR. 11% indicated that benefits had increased since VBR went into effect, and then there was some improvement in retirement benefits. Other workforce indicators, preliminary data suggests that overall staff retention is probably improving slightly. We did ask some questions about health insurance benefits being offered, and nearly all facilities in the state do offer health insurance benefits of some type. Many reported improving that benefit package, and about 40% of employees are now covered by health insurance from the nursing facility. There's also a scholarship program that had some improved features under VBR, and so over 60% of the facilities increased the amount of scholarships that they are awarding out to their employees, or they've expanded the numbers and types of employees that are eligible to participate in the scholarship program. So that was a positive message as well. I talked about the direct care cost limit being higher for support facilities with higher quality scores. And so VBR set up this framework for a quality incentive. And so what this graph is showing you is that initially out the gate, very few facilities are actually impacted by that quality care-related limit because of the way the initial rates were set. And so, again, just to want to emphasize that the investments that the facilities are making once VBR was implemented on January 1st of 2016 are not reflected yet in this data. So I would expect now when we get to 1/1/18, we'll see these facilities shifting more, either closer to the limits and more likely some facilities will be over the limits. So of these 11 facilities that were limited based on their quality score, they're primarily hospital attached. So that would make sense because hospital attached facilities have higher rates higher rates and higher costs that are reported initially. There was no other distinguishing characteristic about those, that it was a mixture of rural and metro, mixture of for-profit and not-for-profits. And so that, I'd be happy to take any questions about the presentation.
Members, do we have any questions of Ms. Cook at this time? Well, thank you very much. Seeing none, we'll ask the facilities if they will come up and hear what happened in their actual care centers. Mr. Pollack and Ms. Brown? Okay. Thank you for coming, and welcome to the Subcommittee on Aging. And who would like to go first?
I'll go. Thank you.
Mr. Pollack, would you please identify yourself for the record?
Yes, my name is Tom Pollack.
Sorry.
That's okay. I wish I could say I was a relative of Jackson Pollack, but it doesn't work out that way. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Tom Pollack, and I'm the administrator at Park River Estates Care Center in Coon Rapids. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. In 2015, the legislature passed the new value-based reimbursement for nursing facilities, a major reform of how nursing facilities are reimbursed for care. The legislation was a major step towards reforming Minnesota's strategies for senior care, reflecting the growing demand for services in a state where 60,000 more people will turn 65 every year. We appreciate the commitment that the legislature made in 2015 Transforming to a cost-based system is already improving the care for our seniors, the wages of our employees, and the economic stability of the nursing facilities. And I want to talk to you today how the rate increases have really affected the lives for the staff at Park River Estates. And I do not exaggerate when I say the increases have been life-changing for my employees. I can tell you I've never had more fun as an administrator when the new rates came out, because I turned around and with the new funding spent $930,000 in increased wages and benefits. Matter of fact, when I was looking at Valerie Cook's presentation, I thought, we didn't compare, but I thought it's following right along. Nursing assistants went from $1,125 starting to $15. They thought we were joking. The employees were informed 2 weeks during the first 2 weeks of November 2015 of what their individual pay increases would be. The emotions were just amazing. We had people crying. One employee said, you know, I needed tires for my car, but I had to pay my rent instead. Now I can get my tires so I can get to work. Another one said, I can actually pay my mortgage with one payment. An older employee had to get supplemental health insurance and stated, you know, I don't know how I'm going to pay for this, but now I can. Another one said, my fiance and I can finally get married. One actually said, I won't have to go to the food shelf. And I don't know how many in this room had those type of statements, but it was amazing. We hired 19 nursing assistants, one RN, one LPN, one cook, a dietary aide, and two receptionists. From 2012 to 2015, we lost 24 employees every single year for better paying jobs. In 2016, we lost only 10. Changing how we get reimbursed for health insurance increased participation from 41 employees to 58. We were charging $77 a pay period for individual health insurance. We dropped that down to 20. We had some pick up insurance that had never had it before. We had some come off of MinCare. And that drop actually gave the employees an additional $1,500 in premiums, cost savings per year. I really want to thank you again for the opportunity to come in and talk to you about the significant impact you've had on the lives of my employees. And being that they're more stable, we actually, our turnover dropped 20%, which means if you have stable employees, the residents are happier and the families are happier. I want to thank you for your commitment to senior care and your commitment to seniors and the commitment you have given us a foundation upon to develop our caregiving workforce. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Members, does anyone have any questions of Mr. Pollack or Representative Lohmann?
Madam Chair, you wanted to say something. Well, I don't have any questions, but what a way to start the morning. Thank you for that awesome testimony and hearing how well things are going. Just is a good way to start the day. So thanks for coming in and sharing with all of us.
I've been in the profession for 36 years, and I get very emotional. Thank you.
Well, it's really nice to hear that there was a lot of positives, not least of which the residents are happier, too. I have to say, as a legislator, that was what I heard was from my seniors, please do something. We don't want them to leave, so because they become family. And it's very nice to see. So, anyone else? Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Okay. And then, Ms. Brown, would you like to tell us your story?
Yes. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Angela Brown. I'm the Vice President of Human Resources with Elam Care. And we have 8 different campuses providing long-term care in the state of Minnesota. We employ 1,200 employees and have 600 adults that we serve on any given day. But due to short-term stays, we touch probably the lives of 1,800 older adults per year just on our long-term care side. First, let me share, it is an honor and a privilege to be with you this morning and to share with you the incredible impact that the reimbursement reform has had, both on the vulnerable adults that we serve as well as the staff who work so hard to do so. Let me affirm that the new approach of reimbursement reform was key to the positive impact that was had in all. The gap between what it cost to provide quality care to elders and what we needed to retain staff was greatly different. There would periodically in the past be a small revenue increase, which was greatly appreciated, but because there was no guarantee of that continuing, we often had to resort to using that money for bonuses for staff. Not knowing whether that reimbursement would be there in the future, we were unable to pass that along in the form of wage increases. The value-based reform, with a focus on quality incentives, gave staff not only tangible pay and benefit increases, but it also gave them hope for the future of their careers in this field. I could spend a lot of time going into details, but I wanted to share a few of the things that some of our campuses did with the additional funding. We used it in a variety of ways. Certainly, we used much of it toward resident care, with additional hours being given to direct care positions, such as nursing assistants and nurses. We heightened our focus on increasing the quality of our dining experience and the food and the meals that we served. But a majority of the dollars were focused on the team members, as without them, we knew we could not continue to provide quality care. Staff wage increases for all staff were given, with additional dollars were given specifically to direct caregivers, such as nursing assistants and nurses. Aside from the lump sum appreciation bonuses that we had done, I had to go back more than 10 years to find a wage increase of more than 2%. And many of those years, including the last three, those employees received no raises at all. So this was much, much appreciated by these staff. The reform allowed us to give an average increase of 5% for all positions, but direct caregivers such as nursing assistants and nurses received notably higher. Many received $2 and $3 wage increases, as you've heard earlier. Due to the geographic constraints of the prior system, our near metro sites struggled immensely. Sites such as Princeton, Minnesota were in rural reimbursement, but were competing directly with metro sites for wages. At that location alone, we were able to give an 18% increase to our staff. We also improved benefits. We increased our retirement match by a full 1%. In 2016, we invested in health insurance. We absorbed the full premium increase of 11%, and we decreased the premiums by 15%, which made the health insurance much more accessible, not only for single coverage, but for family coverage for our staff. And then many of our sites did unique things that met their unusual needs. They introduced shift differentials for night shifts that were hard to fill in other areas. So while we are still managing this interim year until the reimbursement lag catches up, the overall outcomes have been extraordinary. I can't prove an exclusively causal relationship on these areas, but our overall resident satisfaction on measures that we do increased from 4.25 to 4.4 in just 1 year. We feel that the increased hours and the continuity of care are a notable piece of that. While our overall staff retention previously had been falling because people were taking jobs in higher paying areas, in just 1 year it increased to 76%, and our Princeton location at that near metro site had a jump of over 10% in their retention because employees were no longer having to drive to earn the wages that they need to feed their families and meet their expenses. This is despite the detrimental impact that the rising labor shortages in the economy has on retention. So not only did we hold our own, we actually raised the bar with our employee retention on what was given. So what does this look like on a daily basis? Previously, we had two sites where directors of nursing could not even do their job because they were too busy working the night shift. We could not find any nurses to fill that position. They've not had to do that in over a year because we've been able to fill those positions with nurses at wages that they need. We had another nurse at a rural site who had submitted her resignation. She was a longer-term employee, but she said, I just can't continue to work here. I need to take something that pays more. And when she heard of the wage increases that were coming, she joyfully ran into her director's office and tore up her resignation and said, I am thrilled that I get to stay with the residents that I've become so close to. So in summary, thank you. We talk about the dignity and respect for elders for whom we care, but this new approach to reimbursement has also allowed us to do that, not only more effectively for our residents, but to also provide a new sense of dignity and respect for our caregivers. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Representative Baker, do you have?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I kind of following up with what Representative Wilmer said before, and this was a terrific bill to work on last session. As a small employer myself, some of my employees, my servers at the restaurant, also work in healthcare, and they're also in some local nursing homes. And again, they literally were saying people were crying. And it's a wonderful feeling to know that you actually can make that kind of a difference in this job that we are doing every day. And sometimes we don't get to see the results like this. So I'm just thrilled to be a part of that. Also, just I want to say thanks to you guys for hanging in there with us during that period of time when you didn't have that option. You had to really do a lot of dancing and juggling to try to keep those folks around. And just so thank you for your management techniques and styles and creativity and innovation to keep them around. And we can't solve all of our problems like we just did last session like this, and it probably was something that we won't probably see again for a very long time. But it also, Madam Chair, just kind of makes the point that we also have more work to do with home waivered services and adults, with group homes and things that we need to keep working on. So we've got more to do, and I'm glad that we have a path to kind of see how this can be done, and I'm committed to continuing this movement of helping those folks. So thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you.
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two questions. The first one is would you help, would you explain the, walk me through the rate adjustments for compensation related to cost for minimum wage changes, what that actually means, if you could give me an example, or I'm not understanding exactly what that entails.
Representative Allen, that might be a question for Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher, okay.
Yeah.
Is he here?
Yes, but let's. We're going to talk about his bill in a little bit. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So, and then I have a question maybe that would be more appropriate for Madam Chair. The workforce development, I mean, it sounds like there's some good progress made, that the personnel is better compensated, the people are staying in their positions longer. But can you talk a little bit about your sort of view of how you're using scholarships to try to get developed workforce, get so how successful are you in getting people that are living in rural communities to train them and get them into the workforce? Or is it because if the wages get higher, are people from other areas moving into the area and taking those jobs?
Ms. Brown?
Yes. So, Madam Chair, the committee, we have used the scholarship programs extensively in our organization. We use the loan forgiveness for those who are graduating with nursing degrees and others as a way to attract them to our industry versus going to the hospital or other areas, which has been key for us. But we've been working directly with high school and technical colleges as a way to say working in older adult services is a great way to earn money while working in your field and to receive a scholarship which pays for your school for you to further advance. So many people are coming in as a nursing assistant, receiving scholarship to become an LPN, receiving additional scholarship funds to become an RN, and some in need are progressing into management positions as well. So the scholarship program has been very valuable for us to be able to give people meaningful career opportunities.
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so when they take advantage of these scholarship opportunities, or where do they, if they're living in a rural area, where do they get the training? Can they do it online, or do they have to travel, relocate, or?
Ms. Brown.
Yes. Many of the programs now are online. The number of online programs is steadily increasing, where the travel is limited to maybe once a week or maybe once a month. So that really has been helpful for our rural locations in order for them to be able to continue their education in that way. One of the initiatives that Leading Age and other entities are working on, in fact, is even an online nursing assistant training course where they could do the coursework online at a time that works for them with their family and work schedule and then go on-site to a provider or a technical school to get the skills, hands-on training that they need. So trying to work with the remote learning opportunities.
Thank you. Representative Allen, okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Pollard, did you want to add anything to that? Or
actually, when we're using the scholarship program, very similar to exactly what you talked about, but the problem with the lower wages in the past, we would pay the money out, and then they would leave once they got their degree. At least half would, probably. With the higher wages, now they stay. So they don't have to go somewhere else. So it works out wonderfully.
Thank you. Okay. Is there anyone else that has any questions? Well, I thank you both for coming and taking time, and best wishes on the future, and thank you for your hard work. And
thank you.
Thank you.
For our seniors. Okay. Members, I believe we have a quorum. So I think we should move the minutes of January 25th. Thank you, Representative Lohmer. Moves the minutes of January 25th. And are there any corrections or changes? No. Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion prevails. Now we need to go to Representative Lean. I think he's here. We're going to hear House File 490. I'll move that be re-referred to the Health and Human Services Reform Committee. We have the bill before us, and I understand, Representative Lean, there's an A2 amendment that's an author's amendment. I'll move the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Representative Levine, to your bill.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, and I appreciate the approving the amendment. It is an author's amendment, technical in nature, and it gets the bill into better shape. This amendment was brought by the department, and so it's going to help them easier and more streamlined to implement this bill should it become law. House File 490 provides a rate for nonprofit nursing homes located in Moorhead, and this would be equal to the median rate for nursing homes located in North Dakota cities contiguous to Moorhead, so for Fargo. This bill will finish work that Representative Backer started last year, and I certainly do appreciate his work on that. We were working on this together. Some of the work that Representative Backer was doing for a similar nonprofit home in Breckenridge that faced the same circumstances as the facility in Moorhead. And although we are seeing more realistic, North Dakota is seeing a more realistic state budget picture now, in recent years North Dakota had raised its Medicaid rates paid to nursing homes. This led to a wide rate disparity in rates paid in border communities and has resulted in severe staffing issues for nursing homes located in the Minnesota side of the river. The nursing home reform bill 2 years ago certainly does help address the disparity, but did not completely solve the problem for Moorhead or likewise for Breckenridge. And the bill is important to maintain the needed services for the elderly in the Moorhead area, now and in the future, as well as for the nonprofit facility and their staff as well. And I certainly do urge your support of House File 490. And with me today, I have Mr. Nathan Johnson, who works at Eventide Lutheran Home in Moorhead. And he can talk a little bit more about their situation. And we'd certainly both be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Mr. Johnson, would you like to introduce yourself and for the record, please?
Sure. Madam Chair and Subcommittee, I'm Nathan Johnson. I'm the Executive Director and Administrator at Eventide Lutheran Homes in Moorhead, Minnesota. I want to thank Representative Lean for bringing this much-needed legislation forward. Eventide has experienced a significant challenge in the rate differential between ourselves and the 7 North Dakota nursing homes within the Fargo-Moorhead metropolitan area. In a comparison of our 2015 rates, 6 of the facilities had their 1.0 case mix rate about 22% higher on average than the rate we were being reimbursed. To put those numbers in perspective, it was about $45 average higher per day per patient compared to what we were. And in 2000, thanks to the legislation in 2015, those rates have we've seen that gap close, so we thank you guys for that. But simply put, in a competitive marketplace, the differential is not sustainable. A few years back, we had planned an expansion, and we were approved. Our goal was to adapt a very aged building to meet the needs of our current residents and staff to get closer to the market expectations set by our North Dakota facilities. We had no choice but to halt that project because we couldn't staff the beds, and we were concerned with the operational challenges of trying to compete in a reimbursement environment that left us thinking more about contraction than it did expansion and updating. The need is there, but our Minnesota need is being met by North Dakota facilities. Although North Dakota state revenues have declined because of the downturn in the oil production, we want to assure consistency in the future around long-term care rates in our service area. Although there is always the possibility the rates paid in Fargo, North Dakota, and Minnesota could be comparable in the short term, or perhaps North Dakota could even be slightly below Minnesota rates, this legislative change is about creating consistency between the two state systems in a single metropolitan area over the long term. The 2015 nursing home legislation, as I mentioned, has without question helped us get closer, and for that we are very grateful. However, looking forward, we still see substantial challenges, and we want to assure a level playing field for reimbursement for years to come. We want to avoid this issue going forward in a community and metropolitan area and create consistency in two state reimbursement models. And I encourage you to support HF 490, and I want to thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Members, do anyone have any questions of Mr. Johnson? Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you explain a little bit more about what the reciprocity agreement is, and I mean, who are the parties to that? So that's to allow Minnesota residents to be housed in North Dakota facilities, and so who negotiates that, or where do you find a copy of that?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, I might have Kevin come up here as well.
We'll phone a friend.
Phone a friend, yeah.
Okay. Mr. Goodnow, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Madam.
Grab another chair.
Madam Chair, thank you. Take you out of your chairs. Madam Chair, excuse me. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Goodnow, and I'm representing the Eventide Lutheran Home. Madam Chair, Representative Allen, I believe the negotiation takes place between the two states. And so what we have is an agreement between the two states about taking each other's state's residents into the nursing homes in their communities. So what I believe that allows to happen is for a two-year period. For example, if a North Dakota resident came to Eventide in Moorhead, for a two-year period, North Dakota would pay the Minnesota rate for their patient in Minnesota. Likewise, if our Moorhead resident was in a bed in Fargo, that we would pay the North Dakota rate for that resident for up to 2 years in that reciprocity. It happens quite often because there are a limited number of beds in the Fargo-Moorhead area, even more limited in the Moorhead side. And if we don't have the reciprocity, we would have a limited amount of access for Medicaid beds in our community. So it makes sense from a making sure that the clients get served perspective. It's a little ironic that we're paying a much higher rate than the North Dakota facilities to take care of the same residents, who quite frankly would rather be in the Moorhead side in most cases.
Representative Allen.
Madam Chair, but you don't know which agency negotiates that?
Madam Chair, Representative Allen, it would likely be the Department of Human Services. I believe it's at that level. But that would be the agency responsible for that program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We're looking to see if there's somebody here that can answer the question. So. Okay. What's that? Kim Brenny, can you come help us out a little bit from Department of Human Services? Thank you. Should know that.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Welcome.
My name is Kim Brenny, and I represent the Department of Human Services, and I work in the Nursing Facility Policy and Rates Division. So it is our division that works with the Medicaid, or our like sister division in the state of North Dakota. North Dakota is the only state that Minnesota has a reciprocity agreement with. for nursing facility residents. I was just checking. I do believe that it is a one-year agreement, and then they either need to move back to their home state or they need to change their state of residency.
Okay. Okay. Representative Allen or Representative Freiberg?
Just a question. I just noticed the effective date for this is in 2020. I'm just wondering why there's a three-year delay on that, if it's something that needs to be addressed sooner than that.
Representative Lean, would you like to address that?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Freiberg. The reason we did that is because we want to let the new reimbursement system for Minnesota that was put into place over the last couple of years take effect before we jump into this completely. Also, you know, looking long term, I think the big question with all this is, what's the North Dakota oil economy going to look like? And right now, you know, it is down, but prices are coming up. So their production is coming up. So more than anything, I guess this is just for the long-term stability.
Thanks.
Anything else? Okay. All right. Let's see. Where are we at? Anyone else have any other questions? Is there anyone in the audience that we wishes to testify on this bill? Okay, members, any other discussion? You're good? Representative Lean, would you have any final comments?
Well, Madam Chair and committee members, again, you know, I just really appreciate your time and attention to this issue, and this is an important issue for Moorhead, like it is Breckenridge, and we were able to get this work done for Breckenridge last year, so this is, you know, if anything, just kind of tying up some loose ends, and it's really going to benefit, you know, the Moorhead side of the river, not just the seniors that are living in the facility, but the facility itself and their staff also. So very much appreciate, like I say, your attention on this.
Thank you. Well, with that, members, I will renew my motion that House File 490, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and House File 490 is amended as we referred to the Health and Human Services Reform. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, we are going to go to House File 500, and Representative Schumacher, would you like to join us? Representative Schumacher, welcome to the committee, and I will move that House File 500 be referred to the Health and Human Services Reform Committee. We have the bill before us. I understand that A1 amendment is the author's amendment, and I'll move the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion to the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Representative Schumacher, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. It's my privilege to be here this morning to talk to you about House File 500. As you've heard from testimony this morning, we did some pretty significant reforms to the way that we pay for the health care services of our most vulnerable seniors over the last 2 years. The objective 2 years ago was to get some real reform in place for what we were doing. We wanted some long-term solutions that were stable, that the nursing facilities, the centers around the state were able to plan on and be able to trust that those numbers were going to come in. We also wanted to get away from the patchwork solutions that we had been using under the fee-for-service model for so many years, where a percentage increase was not determined until the end of session and was never a certainty until it was signed into law. We wanted to get away from that so that we could have some more certainty, so we could make the investment into the workforce, so that we could add a value to what we're providing for our seniors, and so that we could add quality to the measures as well. That was probably one of the bigger reform pieces that came into the value-based reimbursement, was the quality measures that came along with it. So not only are centers measured on these things, but they also have their rates tied to the quality of care that they are bringing for our seniors. And so we're really excited to bring this forward over the last 2 years. And I think with a lot of things that we see in life, that good things only get better with time. And that's what we have presented with us this morning in House File 500. We learned a few things from the time that it was, the original bill was implemented and put into law, things that we didn't consider ahead of time, things that we thought would take a little bit of a different approach, just some definitional issues that had been troubling to us that we just want to clear up to make sure that we have a bill that will indeed continue to be something that will be useful for us now and into the future. And so that's really what we're trying to do here with House File 500. This morning I have with me Jeff Bostick and Todd Bergstrom from the Long-Term Care Imperative. They will walk through the provisions of the bill specifically, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Bostick, would you like to...
I'm in the other order.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Mr. Bergstrom, go ahead.
Thank you.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Todd Bergstrom, and I work with Care Providers Minnesota. I'm here with my colleague, Jeff Bostick from Leading Age, and we're here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. So as Representative Schulmacher noted, this bill is intended to clarify and add definitions to areas where, frankly, we just didn't think far enough in advance, given the scope of the bill that passed a couple years ago, as well as hopefully ease some of the administrative issues that the Department of Human Services is facing, because we've gone from a kind of a once-a-year type of thing to a very complicated system that requires a lot of work on their behalf, and we're trying to hopefully put in some stuff that makes it easier for administration. So Mr. Bostick and I are going to do is we're going to walk through the issue paper we have, but if we have questions, we can refer to the bill or the amendment as presented. So the first items, and I'll just walk through them, is we're going to clarify that nurse consultant costs, medical director costs, and pharmacy consultant costs are part of direct care. They're being treated as such by the Department of Human Services, but it's our preference. We just put that into statute. Similarly, we have identified additional processes where larger entities or corporations that utilize these from central office to gain efficiencies in providing those consulting services to specific nursing facilities, that there's an avenue to hopefully easier allocate those costs to the facility that's using those services from the corporate office. Second, we have a health insurance pass-through for full-time employees. That's part of the external fixed rate component. And one of the issues is it references the federal ACA statute. So we are not knowing what may happen with that statute as Congress on the national level moves forward. We're replacing that reference with the definition of what a full-time employee is, as we've assumed for the last 2 years. Similarly, we take costs for part-time, the families of part-time employees or retirees, which are not part of the pass-through, but recognize them as fringe benefit costs. Next, we previously had language that talked about other employee insurance benefits, and that really doesn't have any definition. So in the amendment, you can see we actually identify what those kind of allowable fringe employee benefits would be, and they're short and long-term disability, long-term care insurance, accidental insurance, supplemental insurance, and legal assistance insurance. That's the preference of the department, that we actually specify rather than having a very general, something open to interpretation. Next, and this was raised earlier, so the minimum wage. So back in 2014, the legislature passed not only an increase to the state minimum wage over 3 years, on a parallel track, they passed a series of three rate increases for nursing facilities to comply with the minimum wage. And what our bill does is it phases out those increases because it is assumed that providers are building them into the new payment system rates. So to leave them in effect, basically on top of the new rates, you're going to start driving up spending that's not there, if that makes sense. So there's a implied cost to the state if we don't remove them. Similarly, we do add language that allows for known cost increases if a civil division or city or county or whoever decides to raise the minimum wage independently of the state. So that language is in there as well. Representative Allen, does that answer your question?
Representative Allen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Will you repeat the last part you said about the counties, if the counties...
And I forget if it's in the
Mr.
amendment
Bergstrom?
Or it's in... I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Allen. It simply allows, so the language we put in our bill would allow, in the event that that were to happen, facilities would be able to apply to the department for the next January rate period to see the whatever those direct costs may be added into their rate structure, as opposed to waiting under the current system, which would be 27 months, to see them added into their rate structure.
Representative Allen?
Thank you.
Mr. Bergstrom, you want to go ahead?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the other items we have, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Bostic. So Minnesota has penalties in statute for providers who are late in submitting their assessments to the Department of Health that are used to set rates. What the department has found, what providers have found, is often when that happens, it's due to a software glitch or some sort of thing where no one was at fault. And the language that's there basically lowers or provides more latitude to the Department of Human Services to let facilities try and negotiate what that penalty might be in the event that it was simply an error or a software glitch or something like that. And then finally, I talked about administrative efficiency. So presently, not only do we have January 1 rates, but we have, kind of as a holdover from the old system, facilities can ask for bed layaway adjustments, bed closure adjustments, single bed incentive adjustments, all these things at any point in time. And it's our understanding the Department of Human Services finds this to be administratively difficult to have the big January 1 rates, but then also each month perhaps new rate notices need to go out. So in the interest of efficiency, we're moving those requests for bed layaway or bed closure to only January 1 or July 1. And then as an aside, we presume this will also be beneficial to private pay residents because you won't necessarily be bothering them with a rate change every other month, or instead it would be July 1 or January 1. So I'll turn it over to Mr. Bostic.
Mr. Bostic, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Jeff Bostic with Leading Age Minnesota on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. And I'm going to go over the rest of the provisions of the bill as amended. So one provision that's in there in our paper, we describe it as allowing providers to change practices about how single beds are treated. This is a kind of complicated area. It's part of the property rate system, which hasn't changed yet. And at some point, we assume that it will change. But in the meantime, providers sometimes they have an option in terms of whether or not they get compensated by the state for single beds, and what kind of limit there may be on their charges to private pay residents. It's a long-standing policy, and what we would propose to do is just let people choose to change that when their rates change on January 1st. Under the way the law has evolved, you now have to do either a property project or lay away a bed, and there are people who have raised the question of why that's the case, so we just have some language that would allow a little more flexibility there. There's language related to the, again, another kind of property-related thing, related to the old APS, or alternative payment system. There's an inflation increase that has, over the years, it was adjusted to just apply to the property rate. And again, the property rate still remains separate from the rest of the system, at least at this point. And so we're just clarifying the language that it's suspended until January 1 of 2018, and there's some language here that would clarify that the property rates would be adjusted by an inflation factor, again, starting January 1 of 2018. There's language allowing the use of electronic signature. It's a reference to another section of state law. There are some old requirements in the nursing home statute for, say, time and attendance records related to auditing that sort of could be interpreted to imply that you need paper records of a lot of this stuff. So we just want to clarify that we can use the most recent technology as state law would allow. So redefinition or a clearer definition of bad debt. Bad debt is an allowable cost under the new system, and it's in administrative costs, so it's part of a price structure where each facility doesn't really get compensated directly for their bad debt, but it influences what the price is that's paid to all facilities for administrative costs. The definition that's being used there is a Medicare definition, and it doesn't include most of the bad debt that facilities experience. The most common situation with bad debt is around, unfortunate situations where you have a private pay resident, often someone who is trying to qualify for Medicaid, which is a very complicated process, and there's a federally required look-back period and what's happened with your assets for a period of time before you're eligible. And providers run into cases where essentially they can't collect from the private pay resident and Medicaid won't pay yet, and that those amounts, if the effort has been made to collect them, we believe should be considered bad debt and an allowable cost within the formula. The scholarship program, which we talked about earlier, one of the expansions that was proposed in or was in the legislation in 2015 was to allow providers to pay the student loan expenses of newly hired and recently graduated nurses. And we have heard from providers that a lot of them are using that and appreciate it, but they've raised kind of an equity point that they have some employees who have student loan expenses who don't meet the definition of being newly hired or recently graduated, because people can be paying student loans for a long period of time, unfortunately. So this would allow, at the provider's discretion, them to offer through their scholarship program that type of reimbursement to any of their employees who have student loan expenses. Finally, just a couple more things. There's a provision, there's a report that is due and should be out very soon from DHS about the impact of VBR. I think it's going to include some of the information that Valerie Cook talked about earlier today. There is some language included in our bill, which we had talked about with the department, which would require every 2 years an ongoing report on the impact of VBR with some of those similar metrics that you saw today. And then finally, there's what's called the Critical Access Nursing Home Program, which again goes back to before the before VBR was implemented. This was something that identified rural facilities and gave them some additional rate assistance to help preserve access in these areas. With the new system, that became essentially an unnecessary piece because everyone is now getting rates calculated similar to how rates were calculated for those facilities. So at the time VBR passed, it was suspended for 2 years. And looking at it now, there's not currently a proposal or a need to do anything with that program. But we'd like to preserve the language just in case, but again, suspend the funding for an additional 2 years since it's not really needed at this point. And I think we're happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
All right, members, does anyone have any questions? Oh, Representative Allen, excuse me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to the scholarships and the student loan expenses, you stated that you're changing it to remove the requirement that they be recently graduated, but you said that this would allow providers at their discretion. So they're given where does the funding come from? And so why is there discretion?
Mr. Bossi.
Yeah, Madam Chair. So the entire scholarship program is, in a sense, discretionary in that you as a provider don't have to have a scholarship program. There's a provision within the law that's been there for a long time that allows you to provide scholarships and now provide things like student loan expenses to your employees, and you report those costs when you report the rest of your costs, and it gets translated into a portion of your rate. So I stated that it's discretionary because within that scholarship program, you can set up your own determination of what you're going to cover within what's allowed by the statute, and you can make certain employees eligible for certain things and not others. We, as the Long-Term Care Imperative, encourage members to use it as much as possible and get as many people onto various forms of scholarships as they can under the law. But it is ultimately kind of up to them to design their own scholarship program.
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is that something that you could provide us, like the number of recipients, if it's something that they report and then they get reimbursement for? Is there how many providers are offering those benefits and how many are utilizing them?
Mr. Bostic.
Yes, we should be able to do that. I'm trying to think in my mind right now what the most recent cost report would be and whether it includes, I think the ones that are being filed now would include the new provisions.
Yeah. Mr. Bergstrom?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative, a couple things. So first, I believe the Department of Human Services would probably have better, more recent information from the interim cost reporting project that was underdone. But yes, I believe that's available. The other thing I'll just in addition to what Jeff said, the program also requires, especially if you're going to have an expansive program, to the provider to come up with kind of their own funding first. It's paid kind of after the fact, so you need to get it started. So there is a provision that allows, I believe, 25 cents to kind of seed scholarship efforts for those who have not done it. But to actually build and actually engage in a really large-scale scholarship program, it in many cases takes a while for facilities to kind of build that up.
Thank you. Representative Allen?
Thank you. Okay. That's good.
Representative Baker?
Madam Chair, as we have heard a lot of testimony today about how this overall bill and our work last year has really sort of helped stabilize the market in the nursing home care, this is maybe a question to Representative Schumacher about the outcomes and the things we were doing kind of before we did the major reform. Again, we're talking about the scholarships and student loan programs, which I supported, and I think it's a great program. If we start to stabilize things, did we have in this any kind of language, Representative Schumacher, that maybe a sunsetting or a relook at some of those other programs? Or are they currently right now, the student loan programs and scholarships, are they sort of will continue in perpetual time, that where will it ever be looked at again? Or I'm just trying to make sure that we, as we fix some things, are we also being prudent with our dollars to make sure that those kind of programs, do they still need to be continued long term? Or I'm just kind of looking for a kind of a response from the author on that plan of that, if I could.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Baker. That's a great question. Of course, we always want to make sure that we're getting the best use out of the taxpayer dollars, especially in areas like this. I would direct you to the bill that we have in front of us here and what we are asking the department to do in their analysis. We want them to do an annual report about the effectiveness of the program and what we're seeing there. We'll get the preliminary one coming up, but we are asking that be done on an annual basis moving forward.
Representative Baker?
That's good. Thank you.
Okay. Is there anybody in the audience that wishes to testify in this bill? I see nobody moving. So, members, any other questions?
One more question.
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have you had a chance to look at the governor's proposal in the budget? And is there any key differences or major differences that between your bill and what the governor is proposing?
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Allen. I have briefly taken a look at it. I haven't been able to get through the whole thing yet to see what kind of differences are out there. I'll have an answer for you on that before it moves to reform.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Well, any final comments, Representative Schumacher?
Not a one.
Not a one. Oh, a man of few words. I guess I knew that. So with that, I'll renew my motion for House File 500 as amended be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. So all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and House File 500 is as amended is referred to Health and Human Services Reform.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, with that, members, we are, I guess, done for today's events. We will meet again on Wednesday, February 8th, our next meeting, and I believe we will have 3 bills right now that we're planning on doing. So we have to get all our work done early, so plan for February to be busy. So with that, we are adjourned.